On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Brian Curtis and I talk about how the Australian government has new legislature that can weaken global security. AWS has ARM servers in EC2 now, and we talk with Sashi Seth from Oracle Cloud Marketing, who takes us through marketing cloud services and what they can do for you. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 319, recorded December 7th, 2018, Oracle Marketing Cloud. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Interactive and flexible IT training your team will actually enjoy. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 for 30% off the lifetime of your active subscriptions. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And by Avnet. Avnet and Not Impossible Labs created a historic event at the Life is Beautiful Music Festival, a first-of-its-kind live concert that helped the deaf and hearing communities experience music in a whole new way. Visit avnet.com/music1 to see the journey. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need some help from the experts in the enterprise field and community, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi, the Director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, you're busy today. You're a busy guy.
Yeah, we have National Geographic here filming about our underwater observatory and all that. It's going to be, I'm not sure how long it's going to take for it to hit the air, but ought to be interesting. By the way, this is actually an old toy bin that's been renewed. This is JDSU, but now it's called Viavi is the new company. It is a fiber microscope, so I can actually, I'm hooking it up to a Surface Go tablet, and I can actually stick it right into the fiber patch panel and inspect the fiber faces without having to demount anything. I'm hoping that will allow us to go and clean a lot of the fiber and make sure that people don't scratch them up when they start connectorizing them.
Very cool. Very cool. All the toys you get. Well, folks, we have not one, but two experts in the field of enterprise, and our favorite journalist is back. Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what have you been up to, sir?
Well, just the normal stuff that I do, finding out about breaches, finding out about vulnerabilities, and spreading that happy word to lots and lots of people via Dark Reading.
Fantastic. Well, guys, thanks so much for being here. We have a pretty great show. We have a guest later. We're talking about CRM and cloud service marketing systems. But we also are going to talk about the Australian government and their new legislature around customer data and security. And our blips have some more AI built into them. So let's go ahead and jump into those. So engineers at DeepMind are always looking for new ways to shock the world with their new technology. And I'm not sure if you remember, but last year, DeepMind's AlphaZero amazed the world with their AI mastering the game of chess in just 4 hours. Now, after a year of playing Grandmasters, its game is played completely different now, and it can take on the best players in the world. Now, there are other companies out there like Stockfish, which can actually calculate at scale millions of outcomes as it plays, but AlphaZero learns from the past successes and failures and makes a move using a more human behavior that all things will eventually work out in the long run. Now, it shows behaviors where it would even sacrifice its pieces to make sure it had a better position. As they described AlphaZero's tech, it uses a neural network with millions of different turnable parameters, each learning its own rules of what it's good in chess and what's bad. And when you put them all together, you have something that expresses in a quite brain-like way our human ability to glance at a position and say, aha, this is the right thing to do. They aren't limiting the technology to just chess, though. They're hoping that you use this system to help solve real-world problems such as why proteins become misfolded in diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. The reason for starting with chess first is DeepMind wants their tech to be as general as possible so they can scale it out to other problem sets. Now, with the ability to develop a almost intuition-like learning pattern, it'll be able to develop solutions for even our toughest problems, possibly even reducing the gap between the things that humans can do versus what computers can do. Do me a favor. Just stay away from my Monopoly game, DeepMind.
Hey, another day, another zero day. This time in our old friend, Adobe Flash. An Adobe Flash zero day has been seen in the wild as part of an active campaign using the exploit in Microsoft Office documents. Adobe has patched the vulnerability, which is given the designation CVE-2018-15982. Gigamon's Applied Threat Research Team identified the active campaign, which uses malicious files to deliver the exploit, and that lets a Flash object execute code on a target machine and enables an attacker to gain command line access to the victim's system. Now, the malicious Word file appears to be part of a spear phishing campaign targeting Ukrainian victims. Document's header contains an ActiveX control, which renders when the file is open and causes an exploitation of Flash within Office. That exploitation leads to the execution of a malicious command, which attempts to extract and execute a payload. What's really interesting is the Flash file and shellcode stubs don't make use of remote includes, staging, obfuscation, or any kind of anti-analysis. In fact, the most unusual part of this campaign is the number of steps required by the victim. Those attackers were depending heavily on continuing ignorance or maybe outright cooperation on the receiving end of this one.
Well, I've been saying 3D printing is going to make an impact. Here we go. Ford will 3D print parts for the Shelby GT500 at its new manufacturing facility. Quote, building vehicles, the tried and true way works, sure, but an automaker will never discover new efficiency if they don't innovate. That's why Ford plunked down a cool $45 million to build its new advanced manufacturing center in Redford, Michigan. Ford's advanced manufacturing center was built with the express goal of finding new ways to manufacture vehicles. To start, the automaker has highlighted a practice that's already growing in popularity with both businesses and consumers, including Ford itself, 3D printing. The automaker has 23 3D printers at the site and is working with 10 different 3D manufacturing companies across a variety of mediums, including nylon and carbon. Ford pointed out that it's already putting 3D printed parts to task in production cars. The upcoming Mustang Shelby GT500 will sport two different 3D printed parts in its brake systems. The Chinese market F-150 Raptor has a 3D printed interior part too. It's also developing 3D printed parts for use on assembly lines, and they've already been used to assemble the 2019 Ranger pickup faster. The point I'm making is that 3D printing is definitely coming out of the hobby stage, and with HP almost ready to get their CMYK and metal 3D printers out of the beta testing stage, we might start seeing on-demand replacement part desks at some larger automotive part shops in the not-too-distant future. Heck, I've been getting spammed by some of the bigger 3D printing houses on discounts for larger runs of prints for the holiday season.
Now, we remember the days where ARM servers were going to go to the data center, right? Well, even though AMD thought it could be the future of the data center, but just recently they called out they're no longer going to focus on that. Well, Amazon's AWS EC2 services think that AMD might be wrong about ARM. At the reInvent conference in Las Vegas, Amazon announced the launch of their new ARM-based services in EC2. Now, AWS didn't just take on the standard ARM CPUs that you're finding in smart devices and mobile devices. They're actually customizing the cores to ensure they provide performance in places that would help their servers stand out and use less energy to do so. Now, calling them AWS Graviton processors, they're focused on scaling out workloads across a number of small instances. An analog to this is to think microservices or web services. The first release of this service is called A1, and it's now available in some U.S. and European AWS regions. Now, it also is supporting all of AWS's standard pricing models, including on-demand, reserve instance, spot instance, dedicated instance, and dedicated host. It is currently limited to such as such OSs as Amazon Linux 2, RHEL, and Ubuntu, but they are looking to add more options as well. It supports most scripting and interpreting languages, and it provides ways to actually recompile native code to support the platform. Now, Amazon seems to have a different strategy for their data centers, especially since it's also launching support for AMD's EPYC processors earlier this month. To me, I would like to see these services like this abstract away the platform and hardware and just choose the hardware that meets your needs and requirements, finances, and scale. With all those options, services like EC2 might eventually evolve and provide this convenience. Only time will tell.
Well, the first security vulnerability has been found in Kubernetes, and it's a big one. One of the reasons organizations like containers is their supposed level of security. So a vulnerability that hits 9.8 out of 10 on the severity scale has shaken up a lot of companies. The vulnerability, CVE-2018-1002105, allows for privilege escalation and can be accessed by both authorized and unauthorized users. For authorized users with attach, exec, or port forward privileges, escalating those to admin privileges that allow any process to be executed is trivial. And for anyone at all, an API used in three specific modules will allow a query that returns values that can be used to raise privileges to admin level for any API that's deployed on the container cluster. Now, fortunately for Kubernetes users, two fixes are available for the vulnerability. The first is to update any deployed Kubernetes instance to versions 1.10.11, 1.11.5, 1.12.3, or 1.13.0-RC1. Each of these has been patched to remediate the vulnerability. For companies that are unable to update to one of the patched versions of Kubernetes for some reason, mitigation steps have been published on GitHub that will remove the vulnerability, though developers warn they may also disrupt existing operations for some users.
Well, Microsoft expands the rural broadband initiative to push to include 1 million more people. Quote, a year and a half ago, Microsoft launched an initiative to bridge the digital divide for rural Americans, promising to connect 2 million people in remote parts of the country within 5 years. On this last Tuesday, it expanded the program and said it would cover an additional 1 million people by 2022. This last Tuesday, Brad Smith, president of Microsoft, said the company is ahead of schedule with its AirBand initiative, which uses unlicensed TV wireless spectrum, aka TV white spaces, and that's what it's called. And the unused TV broadcast channels were made available by the transition from analog to digital TV. Smith said that Microsoft has already reached 1 million people in 16 states with AirBand, and that now the company is promising to make broadband available to 3 million people by July 2022. Microsoft is also expanding the initiative to reach communities in an additional 9 states so that by the end of 2019, it'll be operating in a total of 25 states. Microsoft and its partners want to be part of a solution to a critical problem facing the U.S., delivering broadband services to millions of rural Americans who don't have access at their homes, farms, and businesses. With broadband now as essential as running water and electricity for improving people's daily lives and providing a standard of living equal to that of urban and suburban parts of the country, federal and local policymakers are starting to work with private companies to close the connectivity gap. I said it a while back, and I'll say it again, and Mo will probably agree with me, the WISP, wireless internet service providers, will be a big part of the answer to help solve the digital divide.
Now, lithium is one of those elements that's really hard to come by, but that hasn't stopped companies like Tesla from scaling their battery technology up. Now, what if they could store large amounts of energy efficiently without the need of lithium? Well, MIT might have the answer. They call it sun in a box, and it stores energy in molten silicon and harvests it by tapping into the bright light it emits. Now, a slightly less fun name for it is the new system is actually called Thermal Energy Grid Storage Multi-Junction Photovoltaics. That's a mouthful. Now, it's based on the molten salt batteries that sit at the heart of grid-scale energy storage systems like concentrated solar. Now, in the past, these systems like these were frowned upon because of the amount of heat they dissipated because they become corrosive as the heat increases. Well, researchers went for the model is if you can't beat them, join them. And instead, trying to beat the heat, they're going to harness it to store more energy. What they found out is that you can store heat cheaper then you can store energy. Salt can only be heated up to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit before it starts to break down. So researchers turned to silicone, which can be heated up to over 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit, raising the energy density quite a bit. Now, the nice thing is silicone is more readily available around the Earth, and the system actually is pretty cool. Now, it's built with two heavily insulated tanks, each made of graphite, measures about 33 feet wide. One tank stores the liquid silicone at relatively cool temperatures, about 3,450 degrees Fahrenheit, and then it heats it up. The silicone is pumped out of the tank through tubes exposed to heat elements that are powered by external energy sources. Now, the warmer silicone then passes into the second tank, which stores it at a much hotter temperature, about 4,350 degrees. Now, to get the energy out, they don't actually use it to heat the boiling water and turn a turbine. Instead, it taps into the bright light that is emitted when heating up the material to those temperatures captured by the solar cells. Now, over the next period, all they want to do now is make it more reliable. Now, in the years to come, you might find data centers pumping their heat, concentrating it, and recycling it to make more power for themselves. If that is not energy reusing energy, I don't know what is. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that is IT Pro TV. Now, there are a ton of training sites out there today that have content, but none of them focus on the IT professional as well as IT Pro TV. Whether it's the certifications you're trying to get, the CCNAs, the CCMPs, MCSE, MTA, and all the other acronyms out there, or you just want to learn about the latest and greatest techniques and technology, including programming and project management, IT Pro TV has what you need. Now, if you haven't already, go out and check itpro.tv/enterprise because they dedicated themselves to helping you learn and grow in your organization and career. Now, from CompTIA and Cisco to EC Council and VMware, IT Pro TV has you covered with everything you need to launch and grow your IT career. Over 4,000 hours of binge-worthy content, on-demand training, and new content is added daily. Courses are conveniently listed by category, certification, and job role. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV PC, or just by using that updated iOS and Android app. Now, I can tell you at work, when I have two new team members to start at the company, I have to find new ways to bring them up to speed on the latest and greatest. IT Pro TV offers that flexibility and online training for teams of all sizes. Now, IT Pro TV is having a big December special. Their video-only subscription standard membership is listed on their site as at just $29 per month, usually $57. Now, plus you can use the code ENTERPRISE30 and save an additional 30%, which means you can get started in IT or advance your career for about $20 a month. Now, 2019 is the perfect time for you to get started on your new life and your new career in IT, or to get that certification you've always been missing. Take advantage of this opportunity right now. It's the biggest sale ever from IT Pro TV. Go ahead and visit itpro.tv/enterprise to get started with IT Pro TV. Use code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off for the lifetime of all active subscriptions. This is itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 for an additional 30% off all of individual and team subscriptions. IT Pro TV, flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've heard of all the stories about governments approaching organizations like Apple to hand over their data of some of their users, even though their devices and infrastructure are protected, like encrypted or so on. Now, if these companies were big enough, they would sometimes push back in public and make it known that this is not something they would like to do, and it would undermine the trust, but because it would actually undermine the trust of their consumers. Well, the Australian government seems to have a different take on this subject. The Australian government has passed a new legislation that would allow law enforcement authorities to force tech companies to hand over user information, even if it's protected by end-to-end encryption. They call it the Assistance and Access Bill of 2018. Allows law enforcement agencies to compel companies to hand over user information, even if it's protected by end-to-end encryption. Now, if companies do not have the ability to intercept encrypted information, they are forced to build tools to do so. Yikes. Now, this legislation is not without controversy and drama. Even Apple's weighing in and saying that the legislation will weaken the data and security of all Australians with a reach that could jeopardize the data of companies, citizens, and societies around the world. Why, you may ask? Well, the view is that if there are tools to weaken encryption and security, then hackers will take advantage of this and exploit them, jeopardizing the digital security globally. Whew. Well, you guys remember the wannabe exploit last year that was made possible by the Windows exploit stolen from NSA. Curtis, I want to bring this over to you first. What are they thinking here? Are we in the twilight zone?
Well, what I think we're in is an environment where you have people who are making laws who don't understand technology. I mean, you get a lot of people in legislative positions around the world who do things like equate encryption to the locks on a door. And in the same way that you can, they say, protect your door while having a key that would allow law enforcement in, why can't you do the same for encryption? They just don't understand the technology behind encryption. This is one of those interesting cases where the internet and its global reach has some implications that are, well, not good for those of us who don't live in that particular jurisdiction. You know, Apple's their reluctance to sign on to this is entirely in line with the problem they had in the U.S. If you'll remember, a few years ago, there was the question of a shooter in California who had an encrypted phone. And Apple said that they would be required to build a tool to break into that phone. And the real question in the U.S. was, can law enforcement force a company to build a new tool? The decision was made by our courts here that they cannot. Could be an entirely different decision in another jurisdiction. You know, I've had conversations with high-level law enforcement here in the U.S., and fortunately, most people in the U.S. Understand that there is no way to build a backdoor into an encryption product without breaking it for everyone. This is one of those things where you really have to decide which is more important. The ability to have secure transactions every day for consumers and people around the world, or to make it the job of law enforcement easier on those rare occasions when they need it. I know where I come down, but it looks like there are legislators in Australia who may be coming down on the other side of that argument.
Right. Gee, but I want to throw this over to you. Similar to what Curtis is saying, what do you think? What's going on? Why is the Australian government trying to do this?
It's about resources. It really is. If you have really, really strong encryption and you have to start spending like the NSA does in order to break open encrypted communications of the bad guys, all of a sudden your budgets to do so start skyrocketing. Now, I'm going to go and set the Wayback Machine, especially since Mr. Peabody is staring me in the face, and remind everybody that one of the things that the U.S. government attempted to do back when strong encryption was actually kind of hard to do was a thing called the Clipper chip. It was basically an encryption processor back when encryption processors hadn't really existed. And they purposely designed in a backdoor for the federal government so that the NSA wouldn't have to go and, you know, spend quite so much money to break into this kind of communications. It wasn't a bad idea. And designing it into a chip made it a lot harder for the bad guys to get access to it. But, you know, it went back and forth. And finally, not only the general public, but our partners, international partners, all said the Clipper chip was not something that should ever happen. So are we doing the exact same thing here? Almost. It's getting really, really close. Because we have so much more computing power, now we can do it all in software. So Five Eyes is an interesting thing because they are some of our strongest partners. And being able to monitor what's going on is actually a pretty good thing. I got involved with a lot of interesting projects that I cannot talk about, but I will say that it was for the greater good, and being able to intercept the communications of the bad guys was a pretty big thing. So I'm sitting on the fence. I really don't want the bad guys able to hide from the good guys. But I totally agree that if you weaken a technology by putting a backdoor in, you weaken the technology for everything. And once you do that, you start bringing in this slippery slope of always having to improve it and always have to change where the backdoor is, so that you end up almost spending just as much money as you would have spent trying to break that original encryption. So, don't know. Sitting on the fence here.
Right. Chris, I want to throw this back to you because I want to talk a little bit about the business and socioeconomic part of it. So, like, did Australia basically sign their death certificate here when it comes to businesses? Will they pull out because they don't want to kind of give this information up? I mean, obviously, a lot of times encryption systems are similar, even though they're in different countries. So now they have to have different systems for Australia or different keys and different so on and so forth for every region in the area. Is this something that will prevent businesses from being there, or maybe they just won't host their data there?
Well, I think you'll find some companies that decide not to host data there. I think you'll find some other large companies, and I'm thinking of, you know, the usual suspects when it comes to cloud service providers who do things like have different versions, in the same way that there are companies that have different versions of their services for China or for the EU. You'll see a different version for Australia. They'll provide something that is weaker, that is breakable, that has different user agreements. The people who I kind of feel for are the Australian customers, because this means that the encryption that they use for transactions, both financial and personal, will be weaker and much more open to hacking and attack, because where you have a key, you're going to have someone who takes it away. And that someone is going to be a criminal or a nation state actor. You know, we do have to make these decisions. Being an American, being the sort of critter that I am, I tend to come down on the side of personal protection. And, you know, depend on law enforcement and national security people to do what they need to do, using the tools they legally can use in order to keep us safe. And frankly, if it comes down to a question of, you know, once in, you know, a decade, having something that makes it easier would be nice, versus, as I said, the millions upon millions of transactions every day being secure, I'm afraid I've got to come down on the side of day-to-day security. And I think most companies would be happier with that as well.
Right. Yeah, this is interesting because I'm wondering if, like, for instance, a lot of these different government clouds around the world, are they going to start seeing this as, hey, like, this doesn't make sense. And if a corporation is going to go and actually let their guard down for something like an Australian government rule, then maybe we can get them to do it as well. What do you think, Cheaper? Is this a slippery slope? Is this going to start a trend across allowing for backdoors and systems all around? Or, I mean, because obviously we already have GDPR, which is, allows customers to pull their data out. Now we're saying, oh, but by the way, like, the government's going to have access to that data too.
You know, it's hard. Like I was saying to the folks in the chat room, I can see both sides. You know, I have actually been directly involved in both sides, and there are pros and cons to both. You know, I kind of do say that Australia could be potentially making some large corporations think twice about operating in the land of Oz. You know, it's always a possibility, you know, just like, you know, Silicon Valley is seeing more and more people moving out because of the tax structures. If you make it more expensive to do business, regardless of whether you're weakening your product, if you make it more expensive to do business, business may decide not to do business there. So I'm not going to say one way or the other. I really won't, because I've literally, lives have depended upon being able to break messaging, especially of the bad guys. But I really and truly don't like weakening a good product. So I'm not going to say one way or the other. I just think there's a really, really good argument on both sides of the fence.
Right. Yeah, I think that the interesting thing here is that, you know, they obviously were forced to do this in some way for some reason. We don't necessarily know what that reason is, but they moved in that direction. I think Curtis called it out and said, hey, well, it's probably because they didn't really understand, you know, security and technology in some cases. And so they just thought, hey, we'll make a rule. We'll make it give ourselves a little bit more versatility here and lower our costs, like Chibert was saying, and in hopes that things will kind of just turn out. But like we were saying in the beginning, you know, like the whole idea is stealing the NSA's security tools. There was a bunch of, actually hacks that happened across the world, actually, on specific versions of Windows that was because of that. So we can almost see an epidemic of this. If it happens, it starts in one country, unless organizations and cloud services and data and organizations that store your data, if they don't protect themselves differently than what they're protecting themselves in places like Australia that have rules like this, it will propagate. It will go across the world. Curtis, is this something that will actually increase costs? Is this going to increase the cost of organizations across the world as we kind of see this kind of go throughout the system?
Well, I think anytime a global company has to have different versions for different areas, it increases their cost. This is true whether you're talking about automobiles or books or web services. What it does, as we see, is take away some of the global nature of the internet, because you start to have different rules for different jurisdictions, and that starts to get into whether or not you can transact business in those areas, or even have your bits transfer across borders. What I am worried about, we've seen a number of times, nations try to put greater and greater limits on the internet. And again, this is one where you can make reasonable arguments in a bunch of directions. Are there bad things that happen on the internet? Why, sure there are. Are there things we would like to be able to watch and take care of? Why, yes, there are. But has the open internet, on balance, been more of a positive good than bad? I think it has. And so I worry about anything that allows countries to have greater control over the data flow in and out of their borders. And we've seen efforts at the United Nations, for example, to come up with guidelines and frameworks that would allow for much more control, whether it be for political censorship or what's called national security, to monitor and control what happens on the internet. I think this is just another step in that direction.
Right. I definitely think there's definitely point of views on both sides. And I think Chumley had said something funny in the chat room. He says, if I was told to remove all my locks from my house for the kids' safety, then, you know, I guess that's what we're going to have to do. Well, hopefully, again, it's not an epidemic and we don't actually see this kind of cause too many issues. But hopefully they will ratify this in the future. Well, folks, that's it for the Bites. Next up, we bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today is going to be great. We're going to talk a little bit about marketing in the cloud. But first, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, home buying is not easy. It's one of those stressful processes you normally don't want to have to go through, even when it's refinancing. Now, I remember buying my last home. It wasn't fun. I had to deal with multiple banks, constant communication with different bank reps, and I had to search around in all my filing cabinets here at home to find the information I needed to give to him, and I had to worry about interest rate hikes. Plus, it takes forever. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage noticed all the pitfalls in the process and are doing something about it. They're calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. After just a few simple questions, they'll check your credit and pre-qualify you in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. Now, what is that? Well, this gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Now, in some markets, people are giving offers right at open houses since it's a seller's market. Now, having this in your hand is a golden ticket to getting that home you've always been looking for. Now, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. Now, first, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here is the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. Now, you're probably thinking, if the rate goes down, they won't tell me about it. That's not true. Nope. If the rate goes down, your rate also drops. Now, if you ask me, as a buyer, you seem to have the upper hand here because either way, you win. Now, this is just the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage. Now, to get started, you go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. And MLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support in this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We get to bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Sashi Sess, SVP of Oracle Marketing Cloud. Sashi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, you know, before we get into all the marketing and cloud goodness, our folks at home love to hear origin stories. Can you take us through a quick journey of your career in tech?
So I grew up in India and have lived in the U.S. for about 30 years. I'm a computer scientist by trade and have worked in Silicon Valley for over 20 years, dabbling in companies like Google, YouTube, eBay, and many startups in between, and ended up at Oracle about a year ago, focusing on running the marketing cloud business here.
Fantastic. Now, one of the interesting things, I used to work in a CRM group, and I can tell you that, you know, there's lots of different facets of CRM. And in this case, you know, we're going to focus on marketing today. But the interesting thing is a lot of times the data kind of connects each other. Why don't we take a little bit through, look, what is cloud marketing? Can you maybe take us through what that is?
So marketing traditionally used to be an on-premise technology that people deployed on their own servers in their own data centers and used to run it. But about 10 years ago or so, the migration to cloud started where people said, just like any other service, could I just log in, create an account, and start doing marketing? And typical marketing use cases tend to be things like I have 30 million users who have provided me email address and SMS addresses or have apps, and so I can do push notifications. And can I reach those customers and send the right messages, the right offers, so that I can increase conversions, increase lifetime value, and generally focus on the things that matter the most, which is essentially around revenue. That's what people typically use our products for, and as pressure on adding new customers, increasing the lifetime value of existing customers, making sure that your most loyal customers engage and buy more from you is increasing, so is marketing responding to it by having great tools that provide all those capabilities and allow for our customers, corporations worldwide to be able to get to those goals quickly.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, like, a lot of people, when they think cloud marketing, they think of, like, basically what you were saying is email blasts, where you basically have engagement metrics. Now, for a lot of times, they talk about, hey, it seems like cloud marketing helps brands store, manage their data, and then they use it to run and measure targeted marketing campaigns. What kind of marketing campaigns are there out there that are available through systems like this?
Oh, so, you know, first I'd like to break it down into two parts. We have B2C companies that are doing business directly with consumers. And then we have a lot of companies that are B2B companies that are working with other companies and trying to sell them their solutions and products and offerings. They do differ in how customers engage with their end customers and leverage our solutions to do that. In the B2C world, you could say, a retail customer might be looking to do a back-to-school campaign. And in that, they might be targeting not only, say, teenagers and young adults, but they might also be targeting their parents because maybe they have more spending power. And those campaigns of how to reach people, what message to put there, how to ensure that open rates and conversions are higher and people are putting more in their baskets and buying more are the typical goals. But even setting up a campaign like that will require a fair amount of work and attention to detail. And our platforms are basically built with that idea in mind, that you can build very sophisticated campaigns and run them. As an example, in the example that I just gave as a back-to-school campaign, you might say, I'm going to send an email blast out to all 30 million people. And if they open the email, I want to have them click over and go to this landing page. But if they don't open the email, 3 days later, I want to send them another email with a different subject line and see if they open that one. And if they don't open that, then maybe I'll send them an SMS if I have that capability. Or it might even be I have many different audience segments and I'm going to target people in the age range of 18 to 21 with a different message and with a different offer. But the parents might get a different message and a different offer. So the sophistication of these campaigns is all focused towards driving revenue. And mm-hmm. the more revenue that we can generate for our customers, the happier they are. And so you could then take that use case and change it over in a B2B environment to say, we're trying to sell more video conferencing equipment. And can we find the right customers, the people who are maybe coming to my website and researching video conferencing equipment? Can I get them? Can I maybe move them to a chatbot? Can I determine when that customer is about to buy so I can send them over to a salesperson and have them set up a call, maybe do a demo, and take them through the life cycle of that that purchase decision? So that's where our products are really very effective and our customers use them in all kinds of different ways.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the B2C, the kind of the direct to consumer type brands. Now, I've worked with some of them in the past, and they're almost laser focused on data, and they essentially use some sophisticated tactics to actually analyze the streams of data to figure out which ads are more effective and getting someone to either buy something or visit a site after seeing an ad. Now, I've seen reports actually that the kind of B2C to direct consumer brands say that buying into marketing clouds is expensive and limits their ability to create custom stacks. Now, I want to get your opinion on that. What do you think of something like that? That some of these businesses are thinking that?
Yeah, I think the reason for using our technology stack or any marketing automation stack is that it frees you up from the platform and the technology and gives you the freedom to accomplish a lot in very short order. As an example, our customers that are using Responses, which is our B2C platform, are capable of bringing very large volumes of data, which typically is consumer profile data, right? Who are these people? What age group are they in? Where do they live? What zip code? What do we think their household income is? Who do we think is the primary shopper? Do they like to buy high-end brands or are they value shoppers? All kinds of data is in those places. And then our platform can take that data and run very, very precise and fine-grained campaigns. So you can effectively do one-to-one marketing with these platforms. But in reality, what it ends up requiring is the strategic direction that you want to take in your marketing. And that requires people to be slightly more analytical, mathematically oriented, and be able mm-hmm. to slice and dice that data. And of course, our job is to make that easier and easier every step. That's where the world is headed. So, you know, to answer your question, our platforms actually provide very, very good capabilities for people to experiment and try different things and run sophisticated campaigns that then can iterate and get better every step. But it depends on making sure that people are thinking about it in a strategic way and not confined with the traditional thought processes of marketing.
Right. Makes sense. What about cost? Because a lot of times startups, you know, smaller businesses, startups, they tend to make sure that, you know, every dollar kind of counts and that they're spending their advertising dollars well so they can make it as effective as possible. How could cloud marketing help here?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the wonderful things about today's modern marketing is that it is all based on return on investment. So the goal is that if you're going to spend a dollar in marketing, what is your return on investment? And clearly it has to be better than a dollar for it to be effective. We provide all the tools for you to run those experiments and figure out what part of your marketing is actually returning the right return on investment. And those are the customers that tend to be very good and loyal users of our product, right? Because there's the blast mentality, I've got 30 million customers and I'll just send them an email. And what happens, happens. And then there are customers on the other end of the spectrum who are like, no, I'm going to run lots of experiments, try lots of different things, because some of those tactics are going to pay off very well and other tactics are going to fail. And I think even for startups, that mentality matters, right? In today's world, if they're spending money on, say, Google search or Facebook advertising, they do have very good metrics on what their money in marketing is bringing back to them in return on investment. And so part of our job is to make all that really simple, expose that to them. And we also realize that many customers are going to go on this modern marketing journey where they get started, then they're going to get better, and then they're going to start focusing on the real metrics that matter. And as they go through that maturity curve, the transformation of modern marketing, that they're going to ask more of our tools and our platforms along the way.
Right, right. Makes sense. Well, when we come back, I do want to talk a little bit about some of the technologies behind some of these services and also talk about some of the different services and systems that you provide. But first, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Avnet. Now, Avnet brings new meaning to groundbreaking technology. Now, their goal is to make technology accessible for everyone. With the help of Avnet, Not Impossible Labs had an idea, and they wanted to revolutionize live music. Now, live music for people who can hear is an experience like no other because it can affect all of our senses. Now, this is where Avnet took on a challenge to make an experience like this more accessible to everyone, including the deaf community. Now, how did they do it, you ask? Well, with the help of Avnet as their guide, Not Impossible Labs applied their idea to one of the most sophisticated wearables on the market today. This system helps bring a shared live concert experience to everyone. Now, they're dubbing it Music Not Impossible. The product allows deaf and hearing concert goers alike to literally feel live music through advanced vibration technology. Now, the wearable technology helps the user immerse themselves and experience music like no other. All you need to do is wear a vest, which sends vibrations through the ankles, wrists, and chest. Now, people who can hear receive music vibrations through the ears. Now, attendees who are deaf receive music vibrations through the whole, all the different parts of their body. Now, allowing many of them to actually respond to the live music alongside everyone else. Now, for many, this was an experience of a lifetime. Now, it's an innovation that literally opens up a whole new world of music exploration to those who might not hear in the more traditional sense. Now, Avnet and Not Impossible Labs revealed this amazing technology at a music festival called Life is Beautiful, and it was an instant success. Now, this is just the kind of innovation we come to expect from Avnet. I love hearing amazing and inspiring tech coming from our sponsors, especially this one from Avnet. Such a really cool thing. Now, to find out more, you can visit avnet.com/music1 to see the journey. That's avnet.com/music1. And we thank Avnet for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we're talking with Sashi Seth from Oracle Marketing Cloud a little bit about cloud marketing services. Sashi, I want to get to a little bit in some of the services that you guys provide, because I know there's quite a bit out there that you have today, such as Eloquoi and Responsys. Can you kind of go through some of these and talk about kind of what they're trying to target?
Yep. So The nerve centers of marketing are really responses and Eloqua. Responses is the orchestration tool used by sophisticated B2C marketers who run very, very large and sophisticated campaigns using responses. Eloqua is used similarly by the B2B community, where we can track individual users, what their intent is, when are they ready to buy, and be able to connect the dots with the sales folks in the company to be able to take people through a long considered purchase cycle. These tools, responses and Eloqua, are surrounded by a variety of products that add key capabilities to modern marketers. First and foremost, we have social listening and publishing, and that takes customers with a journey of what's happening on the internet, what are people talking about, what are they saying about my brand, did a campaign work in a certain way, did they get the right reaction, and so on and so forth, and then be able to take action. Even if an individual says something on Twitter, you can respond back to them. The second tool that we have is called Infinity, and that essentially are tags that sit on your digital assets and listen to all the things that are happening there. So every user that comes in there, what action did they take? How long were they there? Did they come back 3 days later? Did they download a white paper? And who are they? Did other people from the company or from the household come? All that information gets into a data lake, and then we can use that journey to create campaigns and reach those customers. And then we also have a tool called Maximizer that allows for what we call A-B testing or multivariate testing, so that you can determine on your website, should I have a different color scheme? Does that resonate strongly with my user base? Should I have an image on the top? Should I have the buy button in a certain color? Should I have this content up front? Should I have the second content somewhere different? All those decisions need to be done through experimentation. And part of what we offer is simple but very, very powerful capabilities in people being able to test all those ideas or hundreds of ideas and be able to determine which one of those works for your user base. And then finally, we have a brand new product called CX Audience that actually gives you capabilities to create audience segmentation, understand who these people are, and be able to have one-on-one conversations with every single customer that you face. That's our journey, and we are a pretty large group that has over 3,000 customers globally, and these customers are building their businesses on the backbone of this marketing cloud.
Fantastic. So I do want to bring my co-hosts, because they're kind of chomping at the bit here in the private chat that we have. Curtis, I want to throw it over to you first, because you want to talk a little bit about competition.
Yeah, Sashi, I was listening to you, and I'm familiar with what Oracle offers in its marketing cloud. And as you know, it's not the only service out there in the business. There are well-known competitors. Adobe is big. Google has some presence there. My real question is, with all of these, do you see them as tools for people who are trying to do different things? Or is this primarily different approaches for the same bundle of capabilities?
That's a great question. The way that I think about this is that each of the large competitors in the space, which essentially are Oracle, Adobe, Salesforce, and Google, they bring different strengths and capabilities to the table, and they have different approaches. As an example, Adobe is primarily focused on content, and they build their marketing cloud around content. Salesforce is focused around customer relationship management and Salesforce automation, and so everything is built around that. The core capabilities that Oracle has is around data. Right, it started as a database company, and pretty much everything related with data is part and parcel of Oracle's suite of offerings. And so its marketing stack is also been built around that. In fact, our consumer experience stack, things that range from e-commerce and sales and service and marketing, all that is built on that same backbone of data. And that is our core strength. Now, interestingly, what that also means is that modern marketing is all about data and how much you know about your customers and what they're likely to do next. And are they likely to purchase this product or that product? It is all around those predictive capabilities. And so I'd say that we're very well positioned in that space to take advantage of our customers' data and knowledge that they have built up around their user base and what they're likely to do next. And that's where we sit.
Well, hope that answers your question. You did answer my question. I appreciate that. I've got a follow-up. In hearing you talk about the capabilities in many business applications, the place that people are really going is automation. Is that something that you see coming in the future, greater automation based upon this data? Right now, I think a lot of marketing has a ton of hands-on human intervention. Do you see that as always being something that's going to be required for marketing, or is marketing one of those areas that is kind of not yet reaching its full automation potential?
Again, excellent question. We believe that as artificial intelligence, data science, machine learning, all these capabilities are, you know, being put to work, that more and more automation will automatically happen. A lot has already happened. I'll give you some examples. In our world, we have 1.5 billion users that our customers interact with every single day. And we have learned a lot about those customers. For example, if you want to send an email to a customer, we can tell you what day of the week and what time of the day they're most likely to open your email, right? And that requires a deep understanding of these users. Who are they? What do they do? When do they read their emails? When are they likely to respond? But we're taking all that data and building in machine learning around it so that we can get better at those predictive capabilities, including what channel should we talk to them on? Is it email? Is it SMS? Is it push notifications? Is it on maybe WhatsApp? Is it maybe on LinkedIn? All those determinations can today be done by our systems, and no human needs to be involved in that. And the returns on that are phenomenal. As an example, you can get 5% to 7% better open rates when you put these techniques to play. So there are hundreds of these optimizations that are already happening in our platform. And that means that what humans used to do maybe 2 or 3 years ago is now being done by a machine. And we're pushing the envelope on making sure that we add more and more of these capabilities so that that full-scale automation can be done in a grand-scale way, and our customers benefit massively from that.
Fantastic. So, Chiba, I want to throw over to you because you have some questions about business types.
Yeah. So I'm an academic, and some of these tools sound spectacular. Like, it'd be great for nonprofits, but it sounds really expensive. Is there programs available to help out the nonprofits or even political campaigns so that it can start taking advantage of this, or is this maybe a future direction?
Yeah, I think maybe there is a misunderstanding about the price component of this, because we have customers who might spend as little as $20,000 a year, and there are customers who are spending millions of dollars a year. But all of that is around scale and an understanding of return on investment. So we have some customers who today generate more than $1 billion in revenue by using our platform. And if you look at that and say, you know, did they spend maybe $1 million or $2 million in using our platform? Isn't that a great return on investment, right? And so I think the mindset is where the biggest change needs to happen, which is it should only be focused on, if I'm going to spend money, am I going to get something in return that is very tangible? And that is not just for businesses, it is for everybody, even for nonprofits, acquiring donors or engaging with the right constituents and getting the right kind of engagement. Those are all metrics that matter. So I'll take another example. If you are with a university, talking to your students, being able to talk about programs that are relevant for them, their coursework, their load work, how they're doing, upcoming, say, activities like internships, as an example. Those are all things that are important for even a institution like yours. Why wouldn't you want to invest in that? Because success for students in getting better internships or getting hired into the right jobs, those are important. And so these tools make it really easy and they're really effective at fulfilling the goals that you set in place. So I'd say this is a tool that is being used by academics, by nonprofits, by big airlines, by hotels, all kinds of folks, because it does provide that communication and be able to meet the goals that you're setting around that communication.
Right. Well, folks, unfortunately, we've run a little low on time here, but we did want to give you a chance, Sushi, because businesses really want to know about the tools that are at their disposal, and I think this is a great opportunity for them to hear about it. Where can they go to get started? How do they get started? How do they get signed up? Can they partially get signed up? Can they do just like a hybrid type thing? Like, where do they go to do that, and how do they do that?
Yeah, so all you have to do is come to oracle.com and look for Marketing Cloud, and you'll see a host of our products. It's right there on the screen. And then we do run POCs with many customers. We'd be happy to come and talk to you about our capabilities and what we can do. And most importantly, if you're not using these tools today, how do you get started so that you can make and build a better business than you have today? Everybody has goals set around revenue. We can help you achieve those revenue goals very quickly. Come talk to us.
Fantastic. That was Sushi Seth, SVP of Oracle Marketing Cloud. Thank you so much for being here on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 marketing email nodes. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host in crime, with whom I would not want to do this show without them, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can we find all of your work and all the stuff you're up to lately?
Well, as always, you can find my writing over at darkreading.com. Got something interesting coming up. I asked the social media folks for help on reading lists. I actually mentioned that last week here on Twiat. Got some great recommendations, and the article based on that is going to be out early next week. I have some good interviews coming out, and good for me at least, the breaches and vulnerabilities, they just keep on rolling. To find out about what I'm writing about, check me out on Twitter at KG4GWA. Look forward to seeing you there.
Fantastic. Seems like you have unlimited information there, unlimited material. Well, also, I want to thank our great geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Cheever, where can people find you and all of your work?
As always, on Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or Cheebert at twit.tv. Better yet, why don't you hit Twiat at twit.tv, because then it'll hit all the hosts. Anyway, I'm actually going to be on a webinar that Kurt's running next week, I think it is, on Internet of Things and some of the security ramifications. We're going to have a nice little roundtable. Really looking forward to that. And I'll tell you, I would love to hear from you viewers. More and more people are throwing great ideas at me for show topics. And we are going through the list and trying to get you what you are asking for.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, guys, for being here. You guys definitely make the show great. But we also want to thank you as well. You are a loyal listener at home. You come each and every week. You come back and try to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to the show. So go out right now to twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, co-host information, guest information, plus all the links to the stories. But more importantly, next to the videos, you'll get those helpful download or subscribe links that help us support and get the audio version of your choice, video version, and HD video version of your choice to listen on any one of your devices. Now, it's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So go ahead and subscribe and share that show with the rest of your coworkers, your family members, and so on, because we definitely want to keep doing the show, and we can do it with the support of you. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do this show each and every week live at 1:30 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run and behind the scenes. If you're going to jump in live, go ahead and jump into the chat room too as well at irc.twit.tv. You know, even though we're working on 30-year-old technology here, IRC is still one of those great ways to connect with the audience. And in fact, we do have some great conversations, grab some great questions in there for the show. So feel free to jump in there and join the chat room as well. Now, also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You'll get to see all of my information that I do at my normal job, which is at Microsoft. You can also check out dev.office.com, where we post all the latest and greatest ways to customize Office experience to add more productivity. I also want to make sure we thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa, because they continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit. And again, also thank you to our loyal producer, Mr. Brian Chi, who basically books all of our guests, plans the show. We really couldn't do the show without him. Of course, we also have to thank our TD for today, Kevin, Sharkman Kevin. So for continuing the tradition of the show, Kevin, what was the main topic of the show today?
I think it was about a stadium. Some kind of arena.
Well, I think that they probably talked about it there for sure, but unfortunately it was ROI on those marketing campaigns. But and Kevin, maybe we'll get you next time. And until next time, I am Louis Maresca, so just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.